I can remember where I was, I think, when for the very first time I looked through a kaleidoscope. I think I was in year one at primary school. I don't remember much about that time, but I do remember looking through that kaleidoscope. I remember all the colours and all the shapes falling in on each other as I looked through that little scope. And it was really like an exhilarating experience, but kind of perplexing as well. It's a bit disorientating when you look through one of those things, isn't it? And Mark 13, I think, is a bit of a kaleidoscope-type chapter in the book of Mark. Because it seems to record Jesus talking simultaneously, at the same time, about different events, but with no clear break between events, no clear marker to tell you, right, I'm moving on from that event and now I'm talking about this event. As much as the picture is quite puzzling, Jesus conveys an unmistakably clear message through the whole chapter, and it's that message that I want us to take away with us this morning, and indeed next time as well, when we come to the second half of the chapter. If you come out of today's message thinking, I'm still pretty confused about what that chapter really means, that's okay. I'm still confused. As I stand here this morning, having done everything that I've done in preparation for this morning, I'm confused, okay? We're all going to be a bit confused, I think. We can talk about it. That's absolutely fine. It's good. I think the wrong impulse here would be to, because we can't understand it, reject it, forget it, move on. Let's not do that. But really, the message above all messages that comes through in this passage is a one-word message. And it's right there, the very last word of the chapter, and it's the word watch. It's a one-word message, watch. Jesus wants to convey to us that we must be watchful people. All the rest of the detail in the chapter is about why we should watch. It's all about why we should watch. Jesus doesn't say watch for nothing. He says it for good reason. And he's going to give us all the reason in the world to be watchful people as he unpacks for us the detail in this chapter. I said a few weeks back that chapter 13 would be the conclusion of the temple focus that we've been witnessing unfolding during chapter 11 and then into chapter 12. And it's absolutely the case. After this chapter, in Mark's gospel, Jesus does not really talk about the temple. No references, really, to the temple after this chapter. And so verse 1, you can see it for yourselves, says that as the disciples and Jesus were leaving the temple, so we're still temple-focused at the very beginning of chapter 13. As they were leaving the temple, one of the disciples remarked to Jesus about the size and the splendor of the temple and its construction. Now, I'm an architect, so I appreciate what it's like to look at buildings and be pretty impressed. Okay, I imagine that these stones, and you can still see a few of them in Jerusalem, absolutely massive and so well-dressed, and they were pretty awe-inspiring. And Jesus agrees. And the temple was a great in his estimation as well. You can see that in verse 2. But that doesn't stop Jesus from quickly making a prophetic judgment about the temple. It's like he spares no hesitation whatsoever. Jesus anticipates the total comprehensive destruction of those unbelievably sized stones and that magnificent structure, the very temple that they were walking out of. He just says it. It's a one-sentence judgment. It's a one-sentence judgment. The stones, they look big, they look immovable and permanent, but Jesus declares not one of them will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. That's what he says in that one-sentence judgment. And at the end of verse 2, you think that's the end of it. His statement is so abrupt, it's so arresting. That's it. But it's not the end of it, because Mark picks up the story for us in verse 3. And evidently, some time has elapsed between the end of verse 2 and the beginning of verse 3, because the disciples and Jesus are back at their base of operations on the Mount of Olives in verse 3. And if you remember, that Mount of Olives, that position, looks directly over the temple. So again, temple is right in focus. But it's as if Jesus' prophetic word to the disciples has been percolating in the minds of some of his disciples. And privately, four of them, Peter, James, John and Andrew, asked Jesus some questions because they're just like perplexed by what Jesus has said. So the two questions are these: when will the destruction of the temple happen? And what will be the sign that it's about to happen? They want these two questions answering. When and what will be the sign? And Jesus is going to use the rest of the chapter then to answer those two questions. But whereas the disciples have got temple, exclusively temple, in mind with their two questions, it seems to me that Jesus has a different focus. He simultaneously has in mind the temple and what is going to happen there in answer to their questions. But also he has a separate event in his mind. And so his answer then becomes this kaleidoscope of detail about two events. And I want to show you why I think that's the case. And then I want to show you that's not an unusual pattern for prophecy in the Bible. That's really common. So there are details within Jesus' answer which are unmistakably rooted in the setting of the temple. See if you agree. I can't list them all, there's too many, but let's just look at a few. Verse 9 sounds very local to me. You'll be handed over to local councils and flogged in synagogues. That sounds very local to me, very Jewish. Verse 14 is another example. When you see the abomination that causes desolation, which Daniel spoke about in the Old Testament, standing where it does not belong. And in Matthew's account, there's no doubt about it that standing where it does not belong means the temple. Jesus has in mind the temple. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, which sounds very local to me. Verse 18 says, pray that this will not take place in winter. And Matthew adds, or on a Sabbath day. It sounds very local. So these references, they sound nothing more than local scale, I would say. And remember, he's answering their questions. And their questions are all about the temple. They're not about anything else, they're about the temple. So we would expect lots of local detail, right? We would expect lots of detail which focuses on the area and the people living around the temple. But then by contrast, other things Jesus says sound much more large scale. And we encounter Jesus talking about nations and about kingdoms rising against each other. In verse 8, we hear of the gospel being preached to all nations in verse 10. Verse 18 says that the distress of those days will be unparalleled in all history. And in verse 20, he alludes to those days being cut short for the sake of the elect. And we know that the elect are from every tribe and nation and tongue. Now, granted, you could, at a stretch, interpret those things in a more localized way, maybe. But then in verses 24 and 25, Jesus speaks unmistakably of real cosmic events, doesn't he? Sun darkened, the moon no longer giving its light, stars falling from the sky, the heavenly bodies being shaken. And then in verses 26 and 27, he leaves no doubt. Jesus has in mind final, climactic, global scale events when he speaks of his own return and the gathering in of the elect. There's nothing local about Jesus' return. Listen to Revelation 1:7. Every eye will see him. When he returns, every eye will see him. There's nothing local about Jesus' return. So Jesus seems to be talking simultaneously, I think, about the temple with the disciples, which is what the disciples asked him about, and at the same time about these kind of end of all things event, which is coming down the line. And the thing is, he doesn't give us this marker. He doesn't tell us when he's transitioned from temple focus to end times focus. It's like a kaleidoscope of detail. It's mesmerizing. I find it mesmerizing, but it's confusing as well, isn't it? So to help take some of the confusion away, I just want to show you that it's not uncommon. In the Old Testament, prophetic passages, not uncommon to see prophecy speaking to both near and far fulfillments. So one example would be a prophecy like the birth of a son in Isaiah 7. We all know Isaiah 7 really well. Comes out every Christmas, doesn't it? And that prophecy, in its immediate context, was fulfilled in the birth of Isaiah's own son. I'm not even going to try and pronounce his name, because it's too hard. I think it's one of the longest words in the Bible, actually. But Matthew explicitly applies it to the birth of Jesus. So it has a near fulfillment, and it has a far fulfillment. Another example would be Hosea 11:1, which looks back and recalls what God did when he brought Israel, his people, out of Egypt, referring to Israel as his son. But Matthew tells us that Jesus' family, when they fled into Egypt because of the edict, the decree that Herod had issued about the baby boys, and God told Jesus' family to flee into Egypt, Matthew tells us that that's the fulfillment of Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I've called my son. So there's a near fulfillment and there's a far fulfillment. So there are other examples. I can't list them all, but there are many examples of how prophecy deals with near and far fulfillment. So it's not unusual, it's not uncommon for that prophetic pattern to have double fulfillment in view, and that's what I think we've got here in this passage. Jesus is just picking up that pattern from the Old Testament of prophecy, and he's just using it. The question, though, becomes, did Jesus' prophetic words about the temple's destruction really come true? And they did really come true. AD 66 through to AD 70, the Roman Emperor Titus led a campaign against Jerusalem. And the Jewish historian Josephus records how the Romans offered pagan sacrifices in the temple. He records how the Romans set up their standard bearing the deified emperor in the temple. So this is the kind of abomination that causes desolation in the temple. He also records that they set the city and the temple on fire, and that the temple was completely leveled. So we have historical account that records the fulfillment of what Jesus said. Over 1 million Jews were slaughtered or enslaved, and many early Christians fled beyond the Jordan out to the mountains for refuge. So history records clearly that Jesus' prophecy about the temple came to pass just 35, 40 years after he rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. And I don't doubt that the warnings that he gives his disciples in this passage are designed so that when that comes, when that moment comes in the disciples' lifetime, that they would stand firm in the face of that terrible trial, because for 4 years they were encountering terrible trials. They were facing dreadful things. And it all culminated in the destruction of the temple. In fact, verse 13 has Jesus' goal in view. Everyone will hate you because of me, but the one who stands firm to the end will be saved, he says. In other words, Jesus wanted to exhort his disciples to stand firm. Stand firm. It's coming. Just stand firm in the face of it, in the face of these terrible trials, because they're going to accompany the destruction of this temple. Jesus didn't tell them when it was coming. He just told them the signs that would indicate it was about to come on the scene and what to do to get ready for it. The aim of Jesus is the steadfast, resolute, unwavering commitment to Jesus, even though it cost them their lives, when at last this great calamity arrived. He says the result of standing firm like that will be final salvation. That's what he says. Now, clearly, that fulfillment of Jesus' words doesn't apply to us, because we live this side of AD 70. It can't apply to us. Most Christians have lived this side of AD 70, haven't they? But Jesus, by this kaleidoscopic speech that he gives, is showing us, I think, that AD 70 was this shadowy foretaste of what was coming down the line. And as we sit here this morning, is yet future. Okay? So there's a mini scale event that happened in AD 70 that somehow speaks to a much larger, much more global, much more climatic, much more final event coming down the line that is yet future for us. And so this passage is full of meaning for us and full of useful things for our walk with Christ. How much future, we don't know. For the disciples, they didn't know that in just 40 years' time, they would have to go through it. In 40 years from now, will we have to go through the greater and global reality of what Jesus anticipated? Will we? We don't know. We don't know. Jesus says in verse 32, about that day, no one knows the day or the hour. Not even the angels, not even the Son, he says. Amazing, isn't it? Not even the Son knows, but only the Father. But there is certainly no reason to think that it couldn't come in our own lifetime. And that means that Jesus wants us to be ready for it. That's what this passage is all about. Be ready for when Jesus comes. Like he wanted the disciples to be ready for AD 70. So that if it does come in our lifetime, we'll be ready to stand firm to the very end. That's what he wants for us. So this is a loving passage. This is so full of love and kindness. He doesn't want us to be caught out. He wants us to be ready. If we're not ready, we're going to be caught out. So he's giving us everything that we need ahead of time so that should it happen in our lifetime, we will be ready. It's a promise from Jesus. If we stand firm to the end, we will be saved. But he underscores it, the serious nature of the readiness that we need to have by adding a warning at the end of the chapter, doesn't he? In verse 34, he says, it's like a man going away. I think that's Jesus. He's gone away. He's ascended into heaven. It's like a man going away. And he leaves his house, puts it in the hands of his servants. That's us. His house is in our hands. And he says, each one has their assigned task. So Christians, we have assigned tasks. Jesus has ascended into heaven and left each one of us with an assigned task. An amazing thing. And tells the one at the door to keep watch. And then in verse 35, he talks about the owner of the house returning. Now, you check out verse 26 for a minute, and you'll see what that looks like. At that time, people will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. That's the return of the owner of the house. If he comes suddenly, which he will, do not let him find you sleeping. What I say to you, I say to everyone, watch. So Jesus wants everyone to take his return so seriously that it will not catch them unawares. That's why he promises salvation to those who stand firm and why he warns us all against complacency. Clearly, being a Christian is not what makes the difference here. Being a Christian doesn't make a person automatically alert. Like we're all just so alert that Jesus doesn't need to say anything to us. He's saying this to Christians like us. So we can't rest on our laurels. We can't just say, oh, this is just some automatic thing. We'll be awake when the time comes because we're Christians. No, he's giving us help to make sure that we stay awake. He's giving us means. His watchword is absolutely unmistakable, isn't it? 8 times he tells Christians to be vigilant in this passage. In verse 5, he says, watch out. In verses 9, 23, and 33, he says, be on guard. Also in verse 33, he says, be alert. In verse 34, he says, keep watch. And finally, in verse 37, he simply says, watch. 8 times. He's getting us to, this is his message throughout this chapter. He's just getting us to be so on our guard, so awake, so alert. Sometimes the Greek word behind those 8 exhortations is the idea of perceptivity or discernment. And other times it's the word for being vigilant, which probably shows that Jesus wants both from us. He wants us to be people who read the signs of the times. Read the signs of the times. And he wants us to be people who are ready. When he actually comes, he wants us to be ready. It's both. It's not one or the other. So read the signs of the times and be prepared for his arrival. And to that end, I just want to show you how Jesus' words ready us for that moment, which could come at any time. In this passage, I see three separate periods of time. They all follow one after the other, but I think there are three separate and distinct periods of time. And I don't know how quickly they pass, because Jesus doesn't tell us. I don't know how long they last, because Jesus doesn't tell us. I just see different characteristics which seem to mark out different periods of time in this chapter. First period is detailed by Jesus in verses 5 through to 13. And it's what we're focusing on this morning, and then next time we'll deal with the other two, okay? He seems to call it the beginning of birth pains, right there in verse 8. Can you see that? The beginning of birth pains. And I happen to think that we live in those times right now. We live, I'm hanging my hat out here, right? Because there are other ways of interpreting it, but I'm telling you how I'm interpreting it. I think we live in these times, the beginning of birth pains. And I suspect that all Christians have been living in this time since the end of the Old Covenant, which was signified by the leveling of that temple in AD 70. Now, you can see from what Jesus says that it's a time characterized by wars and rumors of wars, nations and kingdoms in conflict, by natural disasters of various kinds, by famines. And these sound to me like events that are significant enough to be kind of newsworthy. So like in our day and age, we flick on the TV, we look on the BBC News website, and we see what is newsworthy at the moment. And we see lots of this kind of thing. And they're distributed throughout the globe. But they're not all encompassing. They're just kind of localized, but they are distributed throughout the world. And I think we see signs that we're in this beginning period when we see Russia, for example, invade Ukraine. Or when we see Hamas slaughter Israeli civilians and then Israel respond by wholesale invasion of the Gaza Strip. We see it when we watch wildfires consume wealthy parts of California with no problem whatsoever. We see it when we see residents in Iceland be displaced by volcanoes. We see it in the famines of Sudan and of Haiti and of Yemen and elsewhere. They're just further signs of the times. We're meant to read the signs of the times. We think that these things are terrible, and they absolutely are terrible. There's no doubt about it, but Jesus calls them just the beginnings. They are just the beginnings. Like when a pregnant woman just starts her contractions. That's what we're talking about. They lead to the main event. They're not the main event. The main event is yet to come. And that's not all Jesus says about this period. Verse 6, he says, many will come in my name, even claiming I am he, and will deceive many. We might not hear too many saying they're the Messiah, but we see some of the most powerful posing themselves as Messiah-type figures, I would say. And certainly John, even in his day, just after AD 70, saying already many antichrists have come on the scene. He says that. Not the Antichrist, but many Antichrists. And so we should expect that through history and even in the day in which we live, that there will be Antichrist-type figures, Messiah-type figures, people who set themselves up as the saviors of the world. And Jesus adds that this time will be characterized by some form of persecution, doesn't he? Not as bad as it could be. That's coming next. But arrests, trials, physical persecutions, hatred for the name of Christ, all that will be experienced in measure by Christians at this time. And again, I think we see those things playing out in the world that we live in. Differing levels of severity, depending on where we're located in the world. Listen, we have it very good. We live in a country with no natural disasters. Do you ever stop and think? Like on Earth, there aren't many places without natural disasters. And we live in one of them. That is amazing, isn't it? Okay, very few natural disasters, very little persecution really for our faith. But there will be persecution and there will be trials nonetheless, because Jesus has promised that all of his people will go through some of that. And amid all this, Jesus leaves us in no doubt that we will need to be faithful witnesses for him. That's the thing. We're going to have to be faithful witnesses for him, verse 9 says. The preaching of the gospel is characteristic of this time, of this age that we are in. In fact, Jesus says all nations will hear the gospel, which just sounds so much like Matthew 28, and the Great Commission and the sending out of the disciples to go and make disciples from every nation and tribe and people and tongue, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. As hard as that will be with this backdrop of everything that Jesus has said that will characterize this time of early onset birth pains, verse 12 introduces the extra dimension as well of martyrdom. Even in spite of all of that background, we don't need to worry about what to say. This is so encouraging, so helpful. We don't need to worry about what to say. You know, like when you have an opportunity to be able to share your faith with somebody, and that thing rises up in you that just, I don't really want to do it because I'm probably going to get some kickback. You don't need to worry. Like, what words will I use? How will I explain it? What would they respond to? You don't need to ask really those questions. You just need to know that when the time comes, the Holy Spirit has been promised to give you the words to say. You'll be given the words by the Holy Spirit to pray about these opportunities. Pray about the opportunity to be able to share your faith. And the Holy Spirit will give you everything you need in those moments to be able to do that. Verse 11 encourages us with that. So depending on where you live out your Christian life on earth, it could look more or less like what Jesus says in these verses. But at root, there will be characteristics of this period playing out in every Christian context. Every Christian context. And I think that's the point of Jesus' teaching. So if I'm right, and we are in that time now, then you might be tempted to think, that's not so bad. Okay, I'm glad I'm at this end of Jesus' teaching and not at the other end of it. That's not too bad. That would be the opposite of the way that Jesus wants us to think. He says, you don't know when this time will be over. This beginning of birth pains bit, you don't know when it's going to come to an end. You don't know anything about the time. You're just given the signs, that's all. You don't know when it's going to be over. And you don't know how short-lived the next step's going to be. In fact, verse 20 says, if the Lord had not cut short those days are going to be shorter than they could have been. How short? We don't know how short. He's talking about the time directly after these initial birth pains, and it's going to be cut short, he says. This whole thing could unravel in a matter of a decade, or in a matter of a year, or even in a matter of months. We just don't know. It's as God wills. So we don't think to ourselves, this won't happen in our lifetime. We don't think like that. We think this could happen in our lifetime. It could. You don't know the day or the hour. How does Jesus prepare us then to live in this time of early contractions? Well, he exhorts us about some things that we must avoid. The first thing he exhorts us about is deception in verse 5. You see that? We must not be deceived. That means that this time we live in is going to be characterized by deception. We live in a time characterized by deception. Like, sometimes I read BBC News, reputable outlet of news, and I don't know whether what I'm reading is true or not anymore. Deception comes in lots of forms, and so the question is, how do you spot deception? How will we know if homosexual identity, which our culture tells us is a thing or not? How will we know? How will we know if biological sex is a thing or not? How will we know? How will we know if disciplining children is right or not? How will we know if abortion is right or not? How will we know when our culture is telling us things all the time? How do we avoid being deceived in these questions? And the answer is we find absolute and reliable truth. That's the only way. That's the only way. We have to find absolute and reliable truth. And when we found it, we have to use it as the lens through which we read everything that's going on in the world around us. That is how. It's the only way. God's word is the only reliable source of what is right and true and good. It's the only one. And it alone must be the sieve through which we push every idea, every concept, everything that's coming our way that we encounter in this world that we live in. Otherwise, this is not so that it's not so that we can win an argument. This is so that we can know what the truth is. That's what it's about. Because if we take this out of the picture, this book out of the picture, we will start to look and think exactly like the world looks and thinks, because it's pushing its ideas onto us all the time. This has to come, and it has to be the sieve through which we understand the world that we live in. Paul says, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. Where do we get the knowledge of God from? We get it from the word of God. And we take captive, he says, every thought to make it obedient to Christ. This is how we test everything and hold on to what is good. We use the Bible as the absolute authority. Jesus also exhorts us in verse 7. Do not be alarmed, he says. When we look around and we see all that Jesus said unfolding before our eyes, we shouldn't be shaken, we shouldn't be afraid. We should be steadfast in the knowledge that Jesus is reigning. Remember how we saw last time? Jesus is reigning, he's on the throne right now. Yeah? It's not like these things are unfolding without any sovereignty. Jesus is sovereign. Paul says to the Thessalonians that they sent Timothy to them to strengthen and encourage them in their faith so that no one would be unsettled by these trials. Okay? The trials that they were going through are way worse than anything we're going through. And Paul said he didn't want them to be unsettled by them. Just think. It's like, how can you say that to people who are being so persecuted? He didn't want them to be unsettled by their trials. And so he sent Timothy to be a strengthener and an encouragement. And then he says, for you know that you are destined for them. You know you're destined for these trials. Therefore, we must be strengthened in our faith by one another. We've got to be coming alongside one another. We've got to be encouraging one another so that we won't be alarmed by the trials that we're going through, because God has destined us for them. And then in verse 9, we've got to be on guard because we will be handed over to some degree of persecution for Christ. For us, that might look like reviling, or it might look like being taken to court, or it might look like family rejection, or loss of friends, or being called a bigot, for example, or something like that. Whatever it is, Jesus doesn't mean be on your guard to avoid that persecution. He doesn't mean like, oh, see the persecution coming and you better dodge it, you better get over here. He doesn't mean that. He means the opposite. He means be on your guard not to avoid the persecution. Because every impulse in us will recoil from persecution, even mild persecution. Jesus says, beware that impulse. He means be on guard against being ashamed of owning the name of Christ. The fact that Jesus' words here to the disciples in answer to their question were met with fulfillment in their lifetime is meant to put us on high alert. That all these things could happen in our lifetime as well. When Jesus says in verse 30, truly I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. And then in verse 31, he says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. He means for every generation between then and now and into the future before his coming, every generation, he means for them to hear him saying, AD 70 stands as a testament. It testifies to you that what I say will come true. There's no doubt about it. It's not like Jesus has said this and this isn't happening. It's happening. And AD 70 stands as a signpost to tell us it's happening. It's going to happen. And you ought to act and you ought to think in ways that are in step with your belief that they could come to fulfillment in your lifetime. And so I ask myself the question, do I live? Do I act? Do I think in ways that reflect that I take Jesus at his word about these things? Do I believe that my generation could be the generation that these things find their fulfillment in? And I think that he wants us in every generation to believe that that's the case, because that will shape the way that we live, shape the way that we think, shape the way that we act. And if the answer is no to that question that I'm asking myself, then I think Jesus would say, in that case, you're not heeding my warning. You're not striving to obtain my promise when I exhort you to watch. You're not watching. You're asleep. Wake up. Strengthen what remains. This is Revelation. Strengthen what remains and is about to die. For I have found your deeds unfinished in the sight of God. I think that's what he would say to us. He is saying that to us, saying it through his word. You know, the owner of the house has left. and is in heaven and is at the right hand of God right now. And he's left us in charge of the house. He's assigned us each our task, and he's coming back, whether in the evening or at midnight or when the cock crows or at dawn, we do not know. What we do know is that he expects to find us awake, because he says it, and on the lookout for him. You might think that that kind of exaltation would make Christians, make me mindful of his return. Like, that would be a prominent thing in our minds as we go from one week to the next. You might think we would be talking a lot about him coming on the clouds in great power and glory. You might think that we would be asking each other, are you ready? Are you ready for his appearing? Because it could be in our generation. You might think that we'd be saying to each other, if you see me looking really sleepy, I give you all permission to shake me. Like, you just grab me by the shirt and you shake me awake. Because I don't want to be asleep when he comes. I want to be awake. You think that that's the way we talk, but I don't think we talk like that. I don't think we think like that. I sense more apathy about the return of Jesus, an inclination that all that kind of stuff is just way off in the future and we don't really need to concern ourselves with it. We're more likely to die, go to the grave, than be here when Jesus returns. I don't think we should think like that. Maybe we just forget that his return will be accompanied by the most testing of times for Christians in all of history. Maybe we forget that. I think Jesus shows us he wants us to think more immediately about his return, that we might not fail when it comes. I think he wants us not to be afraid of it, but to be afraid of falling short of it. Yeah, don't be afraid of it, be afraid of falling short of it. That's what we should be afraid of. And I would encourage us to read here, in the words of Jesus, from his lips, things that are for us now. And to love them now. And to live them now. Like Paul says in 2 Timothy, people who have longed for the appearing of Jesus. That's what I want to be like. I want to be a kind person who has longed for the appearing of Jesus. I would love it if you would all be like that as well.